Israeli airstrike on a tent in Gaza City. Health officials say there's no safe place in all of Gaza City. The medical director for the Al-Ahli Hospital says there's no room in it for any more injured people. The medical charity Doctors Without Borders has also confirmed that another of his staff members and his family members were killed in an Israeli airstrike in central Gaza. Over 50,600 Palestinians have been killed in the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza since October 2023. Our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabeh joined us earlier with the latest updates on Israel's unrelenting attacks across the blockaded territory. Let's take a listen.
As several successive Israeli strikes were conducted and carried out against the Palestinian people in Rafah City over the past couple of hours. We are talking about at least five successive Israeli strikes hit Al-Junaynah neighborhood in the eastern part of the city amid the ongoing wide-scale military offensive that targets the entire city. We are talking about really catastrophic situations and conditions that are still befalling the Palestinian people there in Rafah City, who are still trapped between, as you know, the rock of the ongoing and ceaseless Israeli bombardments and attacks and the hot place of the catastrophic humanitarian conditions. Palestinian people are still completely and utterly deprived of having any significant access to the basic humanitarian essentials, and they are still exposed to more cruel attacks carried out from air, land, and sea, targeting the Palestinian people there. And as you know, we are talking about more deepening bombardments and explosions took place in Tal al-Sultan neighborhood, in addition to Ash-Shabura neighborhood as well. Those areas witnessed more detonations of the Palestinian residential squares and buildings, according to several eyewitnesses there, that Tal al-Sultan neighborhood was completely decimated by the Israeli occupation forces. We were talking about the entire neighborhood that was completely wiped out by the Israeli occupation forces using the Israeli airstrikes, the Israeli artillery shelling, in addition to the constant detonations of the Palestinian residential buildings there.
At least a dozen missiles hit a school in Gaza City where many Palestinians had taken shelter. The strikes killed at least 33 Palestinians, many of them women and children. Eyewitnesses say ambulances and medical crew were denied entry to the area where the massacre occurred. Our correspondent Qadar Ibrahim has this report.
Here I am in Dar al-Arqam sheltering school, from the place of the very horrible massacre the Israeli war planes committed against the Palestinian civilians who were taking this place as a sheltering school. The Israeli missiles, 12 missiles, hit the building of the school, killed at least 33 Palestinians, many of them are children, women, and civilians, and wounded over 100 of the people who were taking this place as a shelter and who thought they are very safe in this place. In just a few hours, the Israeli occupation aggressively bombed the three sheltering schools with almost 12 American-made missiles. As people describe what happened here as an akin to an earthquake, the smoke is still rising from one of the buildings, and people are still looking and searching for the remains of their beloved ones and for what remains of their belongings. Here we are in front of one of the witnesses who saw the explosion and was in the place of the massacre.
I live here near. Suddenly, a huge explosion happened. I rushed to the place to find the bodies of the martyrs scattered across the vicinity of the school, and many of them were children. The ambulance were banned from entering the area, and they were threatened by the occupation army. After the first attack, they returned and carried out another attack. Many martyrs are still buried until now under the rubble of the building, and there are no available means of extracting them out.
Along with my husband and one-year-old child, we're preparing bread to eat, but suddenly we got buried under the rubble by the horrible explosion. We were pulled out by a miracle. This is unbelievable and should not be acceptable by the people of the world. We are dying here. The children were torn apart with no fault but being Palestinian in our own land.
With very long record of crimes, this crime is not the first and it is not surely the last. But what boldens this aggressive Israeli occupation army is the international silence towards these atrocities. Ghad Ibrahim, Gaza City.
The Hamas resistance movement says it has decided not to transfer the Israeli captives from the areas that the regime has ordered to evacuate. The spokesman of the Al-Qassam Brigade said half of the living captives are located in these areas. Abu Ubaidah said the group will keep them under strict security measures. The spokesman called on Israel to return to negotiations immediately if it is concerned about the lives of the captives. Abu Ubaidah said Israel bears full responsibility for the lives of these captives. A number of captives held in Gaza have already been killed by Israeli strikes. Pro-Palestine rallies have been held in several countries across the world on Friday in condemnation of Israel's genocide in the besieged territory.
The U.S. Embassy and the Americans are partners of a Zionist entity. Here they are. Here is Trump with everything he says to the entire world. He is a danger to the world, a danger to the nation, a danger to the laws of justice, a danger to humanity. The entire West has been exposed, and the free world must stand up to expose these practices and stand with the oppressed. The message of the Jordanian youth and the message of the popular forces is clearly and specifically titled, America is the serious, real, and main partner with the Zionist gangs in the war of extermination, starvation, and displacement.
Jordanians took to the streets of the capital Amman, waving Palestinian flags and chanting anti-Israel slogans. They condemned what they called the U.S.'s unconditional support for Israel amid the regime's massacre in Gaza. People in Algeria also marched through the streets, holding up banners and flags to voice their support for Gaza. They called for an immediate end to the Israeli crimes against the Palestinians. Similar protests were also held in Morocco, Libya, Lebanon, and Japan. Despite an active arrest warrant from the International Criminal Court, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has extended an invitation to his Israeli counterpart Benjamin Netanyahu to visit Budapest. As the four-day trip unfolded, Orban announced quitting the ICC in a stark violation of international law. Our correspondent, Dieter Reinisch, reports from Budapest.
It is only the second visit after his U.S. trip since the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant against Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in November 2024 and his first visit to Europe since October 7, 2023. As a party to the Rome Statute, Hungary was required to act on the ICC warrant, but it ignored its obligations. In a press conference, Orban stated that Netanyahu's visit aims to deepen military and intelligence cooperation as well as economic ties between the two sides. He stated that Israel is one of Hungary's largest trading partners.
What makes this matter sad is that today, here in Budapest, the killer of 50,000 Palestinian citizens, and mostly innocent women, children, and elderly, is here in town. That's the sad part about it.
While Israeli flags were hoisted on government buildings and all bridges across the Danube, anti-Netanyahu protests have been banned by the authorities.
Since the beginning of the genocidal war, 544 days now, there was a clear position from the Hungarian government saying that any pro-Palestine protests will not be permitted or allowed, and that's why people couldn't express their opinion clearly.
Smaller spontaneous protests occurred throughout the day, resulting in fines and arrests. One activist who had been fined several times stated that she was not even informed of the reason for the fines.
No, and the second time they pretended not to speak English until I was done, they spoke English and told me they do speak English. And when I asked them why, they refused to answer the two times.
Orban is not the only European leader who announced his willingness to defy international law. This state visit could set a precedent many around Europe fear.
This is, I think, one of the delicate elements of this issue, that it's not only Orban. It may be Merz in the near future. Tusk, the Prime Minister of Poland, has said the same.
Despite Orban's breach of international law, European governments have remained silent. As a result, observers believe that this is just the first of several upcoming trips to EU member states. Germany's next chancellor, Friedrich Merz, has already signaled his intention to invite Netanyahu and refuses to commit his country to enforce the ICC arrest warrant. Dieter Reinisch from Budapest.
Welcome back. Israeli forces have intensified their violent operations in the occupied West Bank, deploying large numbers of troops. Regime forces have also abducted several Palestinians across the territory. We were earlier joined by a correspondent, Nick Ahmed, for more details on the story.
Well, the situation, as you have described it in the West Bank, the situation remained extremely intensive. The aggression, the IOF aggression, is pushing ahead towards most of the Palestinian cities. In the last 24 hours, the Palestinians have bidded farewell to two Palestinians, one 17 years old boy, Youssef Bakr Zaghloul, in the area of Hussein to the south of Beit Lahem. The other is the Palestinian free prisoner Hussein Hardan, 40 years old Palestinian, who have been killed, assassinated by the IOF forces in the area, of course, in the area of Jenin, where the IOF has pursued him and assassinated him. The situation on the ground remained that most of the Palestinian cities are under siege. The major Palestinian cities are closed. The entrances and exits are closed. The situation in the north of the northern part of the West Bank remains the same incursions, the same demolishment, the same arrests, same operations under the name of the military operation, the Iron Wall.
Yemen has vowed to continue with its pro-Palestine and retaliatory military operations against Israel and the U.S.
For the last 10 years, we have been victorious. We are not in a state of defeat, and this is the promise by God to us. This is why we have full trust in God. We will continue our support for the Palestinian people and our battle against the Israeli enemy. We will also confront the U.S., which is supporting the Israeli enemy and protecting it.
Abdul Malik al-Houthi said the U.S. resumed its attacks on Yemenis to stop their support for the Palestinians, but failed in its mission. He hailed the Yemeni armed forces for shooting down 17 U.S. MQ-9 Reaper drones, which he described as a great and unique achievement. Al-Houthi also said the U.S. aircraft carrier USS Harry Truman is constantly on the run in the face of the Yemeni naval attacks. The Yemeni leader also warned Arab regimes against supporting the U.S. and Israel. He said the U.S. is responsible for the Israeli crimes as it is providing the regime with an all-out support, including through the supply of weaponry. Houthi stressed that Israeli crimes against Palestinians are aimed at forcibly displacing them. The Yemeni armed forces say they have carried out a fresh drone strike on Israeli military targets in support of the Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. The armed forces spokesman said in a statement that the attack hit a target in Tel Aviv. Yahya Sari added that the armed forces also shot down a reconnaissance drone carrying out hostile missions in the airspace of Yemen's Saada governorate. According to Sari, the giant shark drone was brought down by a homemade surface-to-air missile. The spokesman once again reiterated Yemen's commitment to support the Palestinians until Israel ends its genocide against the nation. Yemeni forces have been carrying out operations against Israeli cities and the regime's affiliated ships. Yemen has also fought back the U.S. aggression against the country over its support for Palestinians. Our Sana'a correspondent Yusuf Mowry says the Ansarullah resistance movement has been able to carry out operations despite U.S. attacks on the Arab country.
The Saada is where most of these airstrikes are currently focused. They believe that that's where the Ansarullah Yemeni army is launching the weapons from. That's where they're launching the hypersonic missiles, according to U.S. intelligence. They've tried, you know, they've been bombing there for the past 3 weeks, and they still haven't been able to penetrate the underground bunkers or try to or deter the Ansar Allah's capability from continuing to launch these attacks. Today we have the attacks that targeted an Israeli military site in Yaffa, and of course these military operations are in support of the Palestinian people. These are military operations directed at the Israeli regime in order to force them to give up the genocide, to lift the blockade on the besieged Gaza Strip. The strategy for the Yemeni army is to hit Israel where it hurts, which is their military sites, their airports, and also their economy. Their economy, which has been taken a big blow because 60% of their economy is dependent on trades through Bab el-Mandeb to South Asia. And of course, they no longer have access to that because of the naval blockade that was imposed on the Israeli regime 4 weeks ago.
Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The U.S. support for the Zionist regime goes beyond political rhetoric. Washington is continuing to supply Israel with weapons and other forms of military assistance, making the United States a direct partner in the ongoing destruction. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, when the first phase of the ceasefire in Gaza ended, the Israeli regime stepped up its use of starvation and psychological warfare. These measures created immense suffering for more than 2 million Palestinians, living under conditions that have been catastrophic. The resumption of Israel's full-scale bombardment has now made it even harder to survive. The real objective of Israel's war on Gaza is not to rescue captives, as is so often claimed. Israel's captives could have been returned had Israel adhered to the ceasefire agreement from January, which it repeatedly violated. There is ample reason to believe that Israel never intended to end the war. Instead, the Zionist regime is using the captives as a pretext to advance its true goals. The destruction of Gaza and of anyone who opposes the Zionist regime's occupation. Even if the captives were released tomorrow, nothing would change. Israel's real objective has always been the elimination of Palestinian resistance in any form. This does not only apply to armed resistance. The Israeli regime regards the very presence of Palestinians in their homeland as an act of defiance. The Zionist regime does not only destroy buildings, but seeks to destroy the dreams, aspirations, and pride of all Palestinians. Far from caring about captives, the Israeli regime is attempting to empty Gaza of its entire population. The enormous U.S. support for Israel illustrates that this strategy has not been drawn up by the Israeli regime government on its own. Rather, It is part of a broader political and military framework endorsed by Washington. Basic human rights, such as the rights to food and medical care, have been weaponized. Not only are they systematically denied, they are used as tools to exert pressure on Palestinians. Palestinians are either pushed to the brink of survival by Israel or beyond the brink. Vast numbers have already died of diseases that are exacerbated by malnutrition. The Zionist regime's strategy has been reinforced by direct calls from members of the ruling coalition to force Palestinians out of Gaza. Bezalel Smotrich, the Israeli regime finance minister, has expressed a desire for voluntary migration, a euphemism for expulsion. Smotrich has talked about reducing the number of inhabitants in Gaza by more than 50% within a two-year period. The chief enabler of the Gaza genocide was Joe Biden, until recently the U.S. president. His successor, Donald Trump, is now taking support for Israel to new extremes. Trump declared in February that Israel could unleash all hell on Gaza. The Israelis have subsequently done exactly that. Through his comments, Trump gave Israel a green light to continue bombing and destroying Gaza without fear of accountability. Trump has reinforced the idea that Palestinians are viewed as expendable, as burdens, rather than as people with legitimate rights. And of course, U.S. support for the Zionist regime goes beyond political rhetoric. Washington is continuing to supply Israel with weapons and other forms of military assistance, making the United States a direct partner in the ongoing destruction. The Zionist regime does not only want to claim a military victory in Gaza, but to subjugate Palestinians. Airstrikes are not just military operations. There are political messages whereby Palestinians are told that they must not defy Israel's occupation. Starvation is not an unintended consequence of war. It is a deliberate policy aimed at making life in Gaza unbearable. Backed by the United States, the Israeli regime faces little pressure to change course. However, the resilience of Palestinians in Gaza highlights a reality. This war, despite its extreme brutality, has failed to extinguish Palestinian resistance or Palestinian identity. There are questions that nonetheless remain. How much longer can Palestinians endure destruction and suffering? How much longer can Palestinians go to sleep at night without hope for a better tomorrow? For how much longer will the world's most powerful governments refuse to enforce international law? Why will they not stop a genocide against a people who love life but are not allowed to live it?
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, money really doesn't matter. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab on IB English Radio. And so the title is Money Doesn't Really Matter. And obviously as a Muslim, this is something we should, in a sense, wholeheartedly agree with. And because obviously we, our whole way of life, our thought processes, our sort of goals, our desires should be directed towards the afterlife towards the next world, the permanent world, and not just be caught up with these very temporary material things which we desire, and maybe we get them and then we're not happy with them and then we want the next thing. So they're very fleeting things. But there are cases in which people sort of go even beyond that in this idea that money really doesn't matter. So there's a beautiful little sort of story about His Eminence the Sayyid, one of our most famous martyrs. For example, so he for a long time didn't actually own a house. And then he did actually start to, he had purchased a house and he was sort of paying for it in installments. And then what happened was that the office that contained the file with the proof for all the repayments he had made was actually bombed. So obviously, normally we just, obviously we probably have kept a record of it, and we just say to the people, to the bank or whoever was receiving the repayments, we just say, okay, look, this is what I've been sending you. And we'll just tally this up and double check this, because his file had actually gone. But what the sayer did was, and this is what I mean by going over and above this, totally beyond this, almost money doesn't matter. He told them that he'd actually start paying back the whole sum from the beginning, because obviously the file had gone, there was no proof that existed. So as he decided, well, it was just money, and he just wanted to pay it back from the beginning again. Welcome back. This is A to Z and RIB English Radio. And so obviously I'm talking about this idea that money is just money. Money doesn't really matter. We can't take it with us. And obviously there are some people who have a particular sense of justice and piety, and they're extremely modest. So for example, His Eminence the Sayyid, who, even though he'd repaid lot of the money towards the purchase of a house, when that file disappeared in the bombing of the office, he decided to pay everything back from the beginning because the proof had gone. And this obviously is an expression of also this total detachment from money, because obviously this money had no meaning, so it meant nothing whether that money, for example, would remain in his bank account, or he just pay that money to pay off basically the second time maybe for the house. So it had no meaning other than it should just go. And I think just today one of our teachers was talking about this, and this is obviously also interesting, one way in which we can be tested, because it's one thing having no assets, no money. And then, of course, we can't sort of dispense of the money and really show how little the money means. But for those people who, for example, like the Sayyid and other pure-hearted people, other martyrs, or indeed some of the imams, if we have assets and we so easily give them away, in a sense, especially when we're giving them away just for the benefit of the Ummah for Islam, then that's where really this test lies. How deep is our piety? How great is our generosity? And so inshallah, we can all take some of that on board. And I pray that you gain some extra points, insights from today. And I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on IB English Radio. And farewell for today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment. In the limelight. As the Trump administration targets universities and teachers, educators in the United States are eyeing greener academic pastures overseas, and other nations are beginning to take notice. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The magazine The Week has covered the story and tells us more. The United States hosts many of the best educational and academic institutions on earth, and this has been instrumental in securing the country's status as a 21st century global superpower. These universities draw students, teachers, and researchers from around the world to help perpetuate the very academic superiority that appealed to them in the first place. Now, the White House has placed various universities and research institutions in its ideological crosshairs. The nation's reputation for academic excellence is in jeopardy. Prospective students and job seekers must contend with limited funds, the risk of deportation, or even worse. Suddenly, the United States' global educational appeal seems conspicuously less appealing. Meanwhile, other countries are noting the change, with some making plans to capitalize on America's waning collegiate pool. The president of Marseille University in France, Eric Burton, said, "We're witnessing a new brain drain." Marseille University has announced a new Safe Space for Science initiative to help American researchers continue their work at the university in southern France. So far, the project has attracted more than 50 American researchers who have applied to bring their expertise overseas, according to a university spokesperson. Universities worldwide have reported seeing an uptick in applications from U.S.-based researchers wary of the increasing uncertain climate of the Trump administration. Many institutions see an opportunity to attract new talent and reverse the steady migration of scientists to the United States in recent decades. According to Carl Bergstrom, a professor of biology at University of Washington, there is a fire sale on American academics right now. Writing in the health and biomedical-focused publication ESTAT, Carl Bergstrom wrote about anxiety over the Trump administration's moves. He said this is so deep that it could ultimately undermine the country's enduring position as the world leader in biomedicine. The legally dubious detention of lawful U.S. resident students like Columbia University's PhD candidate Mahmoud Khalil is sure to have a chilling effect, not only on foreign-born academics already studying at American universities, but on the desire of others to go there in the future. Concern from members of the academic community is not limited to individual domestic employment prospects, but includes the long-term viability of their research itself. According to the New York Times, the prospect of losing a generation of both science and scientists is something that we cannot recover from, according to the Pasteur Institute president, Yasmin Belkaid, a recently relocated former official at the National Institute of Health in the United States. The Trump administration's moves call into question whole swathes of research, not simply in America, but globally, thanks to international partnerships, French Education Minister Philippe Baptiste said in the same article. A number of countries are considering the situation in the United States an opportunity for their own academic and research institutions. Canadian universities can be an entryway for a flood of talent fleeing American academia. China, too, has begun welcoming PhD refugees from the United States by offering new academic pathways. According to the Hong Kong South China Morning Post, America's academic upheaval is a once-in-a-century brain gain opportunity for Australia as well, according to Daniel Cave, a senior analyst for the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Jonathan Zimmerman, a professor of history of education at the University of Pennsylvania, speaking to the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC, said, historically, brain drain migration has benefited the United States. But there is now a real danger that as a result of the Trump administration's policies, the brain drain is going to start going in the opposite direction. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Trump administration is cutting funding while specifically targeting institutions like Columbia University in New York. No wonder American academics are opting out. In 6 weeks, the Trump administration's rapid rescheduled disassembly of American science has been as sharp and deep as the trashing of U.S.'s alliances and goodwill. Earth science, weather forecasting and early warning systems, medical research including cancer research, NASA, academic grants more broadly have been cut, paused and subject to review for a long list of banned words including such contentious terms as political and women. This has caused universities across the United States to reduce their intake of PhD students, medical students, and other graduate students, introduce hiring freezes, and even rescind some offers of admission. More than 12,500 U.S. citizens currently in other countries on Fulbright research grants recently had their funding paused, along with 7,400 foreign scholars currently hosted in the United States, leaving them financially stranded. And when it came to one foreign academic visiting the United States, detaining them and refusing them entry. Even more worryingly, the administration is specifically targeting some universities, including pulling $400 million in funding from Columbia University in New York and $800 million from Johns Hopkins University, forcing it to lay off 2,000 people. Furthermore, the legally dubious arrest and detention of Mahmoud Khalil and the cancelling of his green card is sure to have a chilling effect on foreign students and researchers already in the United States and on the desire of others to go there in the future. As Christina Pagel, a German-British professor at University College London, writes, this isn't chaos. Instead, the attacks on research appear to follow a three-pronged objective: to forcibly align science with state ideology, undermine academic independence and suppress dissent, and maintain geopolitical and economic goals. The Saturn V rockets that took U.S. astronauts to space and eventually the moon in the 1960s owed their existence to Operation Paperclip, which brought 1,500 former Nazi scientists, such as Wernher von Braun, the former director of NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center, to the United States. In the week after Donald Trump's election, many are wondering whether the German philosopher Jürgen Habermas may inadvertently get his wish of a Europe that unified through opposition to the United States and suggested that Europe position itself to reverse the decades-long transatlantic brain drain by welcoming highly educated American researchers and scientists who were sure to find themselves under attack. This time, there is no moral quandary about it, no Nazi past to ignore, only as much advantage to be gained as can be in a world where the European Union must hold the ground for liberal democratic society, joined by Canada to the west and Japan, South Korea, Australia, and New Zealand to the east. To some extent, European Union governments and institutions are already picking up on the opportunity. For example, on 7th of March this year, the University of Marseille in southern France announced Safe Place for Science, a three-year, 15 million euro program to bring 15 American scientists working in climate, health, and astrophysics to its campus. According to a Marseille University spokesperson, more than 60 applications have been received, 30 of them coming within the first 24 hours. The university indicated that it has been in contact with other universities and the French government about expanding scientific asylum on both a national and European level, and to help coordinate welcoming and relocating different researchers.
Welcome to the Israel Watch. Hebrew media focused on the aggression against Gaza in light of Netanyahu's proposal for a captive exchange deal and the plan by Netanyahu's administration to displace Gaza's residents as well as internal Israeli divisions. We discuss these topics with Dr. Omar Nashabi, political analyst. Hello and welcome, Dr. Omar, to this episode. Hebrew media analyzed Netanyahu's proposal, and some commentators doubted that Hamas would accept it, despite its openness to the Egyptian initiative. Dr. Omar, where is Netanyahu taking things? In your own opinion, do you think he would derail any kind of negotiation, despite Hamas's openness to the Egyptian proposal, to the latest Egyptian proposal?
I mean, every day, more than the day before, it's very clear that the plan is to do a genocide in Gaza.
Yes.
And the objective of the genocide is to kill everybody. I mean, this is what a genocide is defined. It's defined as killing all the population that's there and depriving the Palestinians from livelihood in this part of the world. He wants to take control of Gaza without its population. Now, this is what he wants. Now, how does he get there? He gets there by lying and by trying to deceive the whole world by saying that he is into the agreement, which has two phases. We finished the first phase. He didn't start the second phase. He wants to delay it. He wants to find any twisted arguments to actually come up with some ideas.
Now, excuses.
Yes, excuses, definitely. And he wants to try to continue the bombing and expand the bombing, especially during Eid.
Yes.
We have this is a holy month of Ramadan. This is a time when people, it's the holiest time in Islam for all Muslims. Children are, trying to celebrate Ramadan, and they're being slaughtered and killed with their with the clothes of the Eid. This is tragic. I mean, he's targeting ambulances, trying to show more aggression, more violence.
That reflects what so you're highlighting, that this is a genocide and a complete genocide, and that's how a genocide looks like. The Israeli commentator in the report, Dr. Omar, believes that the second phase of the agreement remains a sticking point for Netanyahu's administration. Do you think that without the second phase, this agreement will not be moving forward?
Definitely. Well, there was an agreement, and they agreed to it, and they are supposed to be guarantees for the agreement, which are the United States and the Qatar and Egypt, which is and they're supposed to pressure the Israelis so that we can start phase two in the negotiations. This is what Hamas wants. This is what Hamas announced. Now, the commentator said that You know, the Hamas has been showing like this kind of pacifist approach towards the Egyptian
yes.
initiative. Well, the Hamas has always been very, you know, positive about anything that comes from the Egyptians, because they hold on to remaining on good terms with the Egyptians, with the Qataris, so that the negotiations can continue in the future. That doesn't mean, however,
but
that
the
Hamas
Israelis
would comply.
Are saying, or the cabinet, or Netanyahu's cabinet is always highlighting and saying that the Hamas are the one that are keeping obstacles in the way of this agreement.
Well, that's a complete illusion. In fact, Hamas, from the beginning, even before these negotiations started, Hamas was ready to have a full, comprehensive exchange of all the prisoners of war. From day one. That is in 2023. I mean, like this is like almost 2 years ago, and Hamas never changed its position. Its position
yes.
is very clear. It's ready to negotiate and to exchange. However, no one would expect Hamas or anyone else to commit suicide by accepting terms that will lead to its annihilation.
Okay.
That's not possible.
Do we stay in Gaza, where criticism within Israel is escalating against Netanyahu's administration for breaking the ceasefire agreement, as we are highlighting, in both Gaza and Lebanon? A former Knesset member held Netanyahu fully responsible for what she called the return of fighting in Gaza and Lebanon. Dr. Amar, we want to actually understand why all this is happening. A major question is asked. Domestic political calculations, the Israelis in Israel, is this what is banning, or this is what is not allowing Netanyahu to come to a straight decision here and just escalating in all sides?
I think within the Israeli entities population, there are some divisions. The Netanyahu camp believes in violent deterrent techniques. He believes that more blood, more killing, more destruction, you know, will lead to positive results. That he wants to pressure Hamas, pressure the whole world, saying that Israel can kill anyone, can burn, can do a genocide. Nobody's gonna do anything about
he
it.
He still
and you'll
believes
have to,
that after all
I
what
think
happened?
He still believes that. And I think many Israelis still believe that. So what the problem is, and this member of Knesset, and
yes.
this Israeli person,
mm-hmm.
has the other perspective, the perspective that, no, when we do a peace, talks with the adversaries or
yes.
the enemies of Israel, when we reach an agreement for ceasefire, this ceasefire agreement must be respected.
Okay.
Clearly, the Netanyahu cabinet and the Netanyahu administration is not respecting any agreement. This will make the Israeli entity lose what's left of its credibility in the international community also. And it will show that the Israelis are liars, simply. Mm-hmm. They just want to continue with the bloodshed, with the genocide. They want to continue slaughtering innocent people, innocent civilians, everywhere in southern Lebanon and in Yemen
mm-hmm.
also,
okay.
and in Gaza and the West Bank.
Okay.
And this is ongoing. This is what the Israelis, the Israelis
because
more than ever.
Because they do have a green light from the United States.
Yes, but they're showing
forward,
more than
Dr.
ever.
Ahmad.
They're showing the whole world
mm-hmm.
more than ever that
okay.
they survive based on bloodshed. They survive based on killing other people. No nation or no entity in the world can exist that is founded on the killing of others.
And I think that became obvious to most people. And now, dear viewers, to the plan to displace Gaza's residents, which Netanyahu's administration has put in place and is being heavily promoted in Hebrew media, alongside claims that a large number of Gaza residents want to leave, as we will see.
יש יציאה מעזה בדרכים שונות, גם בנושא הזה וגם בנושא של ההפגנות, יש לי תחינה חרישית שמישהו בישראל סוף סוף יסתום את הפה. פשוט ניתן לדברים להיות, לעשות את שלהם, בלי יותר מדי יחץ ובלי, זה לתת לתהליכים להיות בלי השפעה ישראלית. יש רצון גדול לצאת מעזה, סקר שפורסם בעיתון הבריטי טלגרף, על ידי מכון גלופ, אומר שמחצית מהאוכלוסייה רוצה לצאת, בין אם באופן זמני או קבוע, עכשיו אפשר לנחש שהמספרים האמיתיים יותר גבוהים, אנשים לא כל כך רוצים לשתף פעולה, הם לא יודעים מי בצד השני של הטלפון, או במקרה הזה של הטלפון החכם.
וגם יש דעת קהל עולמית שרואה בזה צעד מאוד בעייתי, ומדברים במונחים של טרנספר.
תלוי באיזה צעד. אם זה הגירת עבודה, לא תראי אף אחד בעולם שיוצא נגד זה. אם מדובר בבעלי דרכונים זרים למשל, סתם נסבר את האוזן, מתוך 1,700,000 עזתים, 200 עד 250,000 הם או בני משפחותיהם בעלי דרכונים זרים. כל האנשים האלה יכולים לצאת בלי שמישהו יצייץ. עכשיו, אני אגיד לך מה ההבדל בין ההשקפה הזאת לבין ההשקפה של טראמפ. Mm-hmm. טראמפ לכאורה, עד שלא יוצא עזתי אחרון, לא יעשה כלום. בעיניי, אם 250 אלף, 300 אלף עזתים עוזבים, תקראי לזה עבודה, תקראי לזה דרכונים זרים, תקראי לזה ייאוש או טיפול רפואי, זה הישג אדיר, okay. זאת נקבה שנייה מבחינתם, וזה העיתות. אתם רציתם שבערי וניר עוז וכפר עזה יעזבו, בסוף ג'באליה ושג'אייה וחניונס הזה.
What is the occupation's goal in promoting the migration of Palestinians from Gaza?
Well, that has been their objective since 1948. I mean, since before 1948. This is a Zionist project, is to push people out of their land. Now, this man is justifying mass crime. He's justifying genocide. He's justifying displacement. He's not recognizing the basic rights to their own land, the basic rights to people for self-determination, which is an international law. Mm-hmm. He's saying that 250,000 of the Palestinians have foreign passports. Is that what he's saying? Mm-hmm. There are 5 million Israelis. They are all Europeans from Ukraine and from Poland and from the United States and from France and from Morocco and Yemen and other countries. And he's saying that out of the inhabitants of Gaza, there are 250,000.
Okay, and you're an expert on criminal justice. What is the legal perspective from this, Dr.
Well, this
Ahmad?
Is an international crime. It's very clear. I mean, Gaza is part of the state of Palestine that is recognized in the United Nations as an entity. These people have the right to self-determination. They have the right to exist as a people. I mean, this is really flagrant.
Do you think that that's obvious now to the world, that the Israelis do not perceive the Palestinians as people that have the rights that you're highlighting?
Well, not just the Israelis.
The legal rights.
Well, not just the Israelis and everyone who supports the Israelis in that sense, and some of the Arabs who support the Israelis as well. I mean, there's no respect for human dignity for these people in Gaza. They just think that slaughtering them and kicking them out of their homes and killing their children on Eid is a right for the Israelis and those who support them. I mean, the problem is not just with the
Israelis. So the resumption of killings and genocide is for that perspective, in your opinion, to push towards migration, in your opinion.
Exactly, and that's not just the problem of the Israelis. That's the problem of those who support them. That's the problem of the Arab and Islamic world that is watching this and doing nothing about it.
Israeli social media well engaged with the media campaign to displace Gaza residents. Here are some comments from the Zionist activists.
Dor Hanetzahon. They want to leave, so let them leave. An immigration directorate has been established in Israel. The president of the world's greatest power, Trump, supports us. Norwit Yohanan. The amount of fantasy involved in the idea of migration from Gaza is unbelievable. Egypt has denied twice in half a week that it has agreed to migration or to receiving 2 million people from Gaza in Sinai. Amit Malmad. The only way to stop this vicious cycle is to refuse the return of war to Gaza. We've already tried everything. Reject the killing of captive soldiers and the residents of Gaza.
Dr. Ahmad, what grabbed your attention in these comments that we just heard together?
Well, these comments, I mean, what grabbed my attention is that they focus on something that they call migration of Palestinians from Gaza. It's not about migration. It's a big lie. This is forced displacement. This is ethnic cleansing. This is.
But they said that they agreed that Egypt refuses this migration, some of the writers.
Yeah,
actually.
But even using the term migration is what caught my attention. And of course, the Egyptians are going to refuse it in public. I mean, we don't know what's happening.
They will agree under
I'm
the
not
table?
Sure. Well, let's see what they're doing because, you know.
For what
in
benefit?
The past, well, in the past, Egypt has shown a lot of, you know, setback in the negotiations, shown a lot of, you know, a fear that they will lose the American support. You have to remember that Egypt has like billions of dollars of debt and they are having really serious economic problems. And their economic problems started to amplify after they signed the peace talks with the Israelis in Camp David, in fact. You know, but this is how the Israelis function, the Americans. They put these countries
under pressure.
Under immense pressure so that they cannot
But they
come.
Declared it to the public, whether the Jordanian or the Egyptians, that they refuse the plan that Trump actually highlighted.
Well, all the Arab leaders declared in public that they support the Palestinian people. I mean, I haven't heard any Arab country saying things that are, you know, that are similar to the actions of supporting the Israelis or just not doing anything about it when they're committing a genocide for almost 2 years now. This is a genocide. It's the most dangerous of any crime, and it should be rejected. If it's not rejected, well, there's a collapse of the world order. We are witnessing a collapse in the
but
world.
But Saudi Arabia is calling for a two-state solution, and that's the mission that they're working upon.
Well, it's not enough. These are just words. We need some action. What two-state solution? I mean, what kind of, we need a viable state, a Palestinian viable state. The solution for Palestine is outlined in Imam Ali Khamenei's book, Qadiyat Palestine, very clearly. I mean, there is, I mean, I invite everyone to read that solution.
Okay.
It could be a logical solution where it could be a baseline to start negotiations if anyone is serious about finding solutions for the Palestinian people.
Okay. Well, total victory, a false term Netanyahu has used dozens of times since the beginning of the war of extermination in Gaza. He continues to use it despite failing to achieve it. A military analyst in Hebrew media examined cases where Netanyahu invoked this term. What is the significance of Hebrew media reminding constantly people of Netanyahu's statements? Absolute victory, total victory.
Well, because the war is ongoing. I mean, the slaughtering is ongoing. What absolute victory? What absolute victory for the Israeli entity when Israel today, creates more threats to the Jewish people all around the world?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Jewish people, you know, wanted to have a state, the state of Israel, so that they can have more security. Now they have less security,
yes.
One. The second thing is that the Palestinian cause wasn't very well known to the whole world before 2023. Today, everybody recognizes the Palestinian flag and the right for the Palestinian people to have their own nation. Palestine is known all over the world more than ever.
And how will these
and
factors
third,
affect the Israelis?
Well, of course it will affect.
Because on their hand, they keep on highlighting, or Netanyahu's keep on highlighting, that we will achieve absolute victory and total victory.
I mean, they're committing the biggest
contradiction. They're not aware of all the deficiencies?
They're committing the biggest contradiction ever. You see, the Israeli people have been saying that they are the victims of the Holocaust. They're victims,
yes,
of the brutality of the
calling
Europeans.
For anti-Semitism.
And what they're doing now, is they're doing the exact same thing. You know, they're committing all the crimes that they said that they were victims of these crimes. Now, and they're violating all international law. They're committing genocide all over the world. Everyone can see the pictures. Everyone can see the images. All the arguments to justify this genocide are not strong enough. They're not convincing for the whole world, especially when the slaughtering is ongoing, when they see pictures of kids being slaughtered. I mean, they're trying to prove to the whole world that the Jewish people are the chosen people and they are
okay,
superior to all other people and they have the right to life, whereas the Palestinians, where they have the right to eliminate life and eliminate Palestine, eliminate the right of the Palestinian people to exist.
Yes, massacre them or push for migration, as you were highlighting.
And
the whole world is seeing. And now to the internal divisions and disputes within Israel, which intensified after the dismissal of the Shin Bet chief and the cabinet's legal advisor. The divisions deepened with protests and demonstrations in the streets, which, despite their momentum, are unlikely to push Netanyahu to change his policies. Dr. Amar, do you really think that all these disputes that we're seeing now in Israel, divisions and protests that we have never actually, remarkable ones, never seen in Israel before, will actually affect Netanyahu's decision?
I don't think it will affect him. However, I think they are very important. It's very important to look at the core of the disputes within the Israelis themselves. And that dispute started before the genocide started in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
From the
families of the captives?
No, before that.
Okay.
It was a problem over judicial overhaul. And, there was a debate among the Israelis, should we have a state where the law takes precedence or where political interests take precedence? And that is the actual battle. They should realize that the actual Israeli entity cannot exist based on law, cannot exist based on legal premises. This is not a debate. These are criminals. The entity is a criminal entity. They're trying to create a court and a prosecutor and things like that. This debate is at the core of the existence of the entity of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Because this entity cannot exist based on a legal status, you see? So when he removes the chief of the Shin Bet and he decides to replace him with another guy.
And ignore the massive demonstrations and
protests. Ignore the massive demonstration, ignore the prosecutor that he calls the prosecutor of the Zionist entity. try to behave in a way where Netanyahu is trying to tell his people that, you know, Israel can only exist based on bloodshed and genocide. We have to kill other people to exist.
Okay.
We have to slaughter them. We have to violate international law to exist. And it is what he's saying to them. He's saying it is our right as a chosen people, as a Jewish people, as Zionists, to do this. And no one can actually object to that.
Okay.
And the other Israelis are having this illusion and telling him, no, we can have, you know, Israel has the right to exist because it is based on some, you know, on the right for the Jewish people to defend themselves, to have a land for themselves after they've been, they suffered from the